Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back liquidity guru Michael Howell. Today, instead of Michael Howell giving us his overall global macroeconomic outlook and opinions on liquidity, we're going to switch it up. Today, we are going to teach Michael Howell how Bitcoin works and specifically answer his question, what makes Bitcoin so special? Michael, it's great to see you.
Nick, great to be here. I'm looking forward to this very much. So let's go for it.
So the premise behind the conversation, Michael, was that you and I were chatting about Bitcoin, about global markets, about our frameworks. And you asked me a question that made me understand you hadn't understood yet Bitcoin mining and what that process was, preventing you from understanding what makes Bitcoin so unique in comparison to other cryptocurrencies. So our goal today is to really teach you Bitcoin mining. That's the end goal, because I think when you understand Bitcoin mining, the light bulb will go on and you will understand why Bitcoin itself is the special thing. So okay. What are your thoughts before we get in here?
Well, I think my thoughts are that if you take it from the standpoint of, let's say, monetary economics, two of the critical questions to ask, or two of the critical laws to try and understand, one is Gresham's law, which is bad money drives out good from circulation. So I wonder to what extent Bitcoin, if Bitcoin is money or a form of money, that law, which has existed for centuries, applies, and how can we craft application of that. And I think the second question, which is a connected or a connected thought again from monetary economics, is where does Triffin's dilemma, which is another rule, where does that fit in? And Triffin's dilemma, as one remembers, was applied to the US dollar, particularly in the early 1970s, when there was a conflict between the elasticity of credit money and the limited supply of commodity money. That being gold. So effectively the dollar or the federal deficits, the US deficits, were compromising the gold backing of the US dollar. And Nixon, as we recall in August 71, cut the dollar free from gold. So I think those questions are very important questions in monetary economics. And it would certainly help my understanding of the role of Bitcoin to see how Bitcoin fits in, or whether it bends those laws, or whether it satisfies those laws.
That's a great point. And the first question that you have about good money, we will definitely be working towards answering in this lecture. And by the way, guys, this probably will go over multiple parts, because we can't just teach Bitcoin in an hour. That's not how it works. We really want to explain Bitcoin mining. The second question, which is about Triffin's dilemma, about the global monetary system and how Bitcoin fits in, that'll be a longer conversation, Michael, because I think that once you see Bitcoin for what it is, we can explore the future of the financial system, specifically the coexistence of a credit system and good money. And they don't have to be denominated in the same thing anymore. And that's, I think, the goal of the takeaway, but we'll get there. Okay, so what we are going to do for everyone at home is we are going to have a presentation up here. And this presentation is one that I teach to my students at USC Marshall School of Business. And the reason that I wanted to bring that slide deck to Michael is because it's the way I'm familiar and comfortable teaching Bitcoin. So we're going to just lay it out and give us time, Michael, to get to Bitcoin mining, because we might not even get to it in this first hour. But we'll work our way towards that with some definitions and some groundwork. Now, the three core tenets of Bitcoin for this lecture to understand where are we going and what is Bitcoin. Number one, Bitcoin is an internet protocol. So that is the first definition, Michael. It's not that Bitcoin is money. That's really second. But first is that it's an internet protocol. So we're going to attempt to understand Bitcoin as a protocol before we can understand the money within that protocol, because they're both named Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is the name of the protocol, the name of the software, the name of the idea, and the name of the research paper. Those are all called Bitcoin. Within that software, there's a unit. There's a unit of account. It is also now called Bitcoin. So that's why we say the price of one Bitcoin is 60,000 US dollars. That is 1.00000 Bitcoin within the Bitcoin protocol software. Okay, that's the first thing. So Bitcoin is an internet protocol. The second thing is that Bitcoin is property. So the unit of account within the protocol can be looked at as property. Now, the reason that it's property, Michael, and not an entry or an account with a company or a login, that it's more similar to a physical key in your hand, a single metal key, because the key that you hold is actually a number. It's a scarce number. It's your own number. But it's a number that no one else knows. No one else knows it, and it's mathematically improbable to guess it. We're going to get more into that mathematical improbability today because it's the foundation of Bitcoin, and it's actually the foundation of cryptography, not just Bitcoin. Bitcoin came after cryptography. So the third tenet of Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is money. So it's that key, it's that number. It's money without financial institutions. So you don't need Fedwire. And for everyone at home, I'm going to speak Michael's language. Michael is a, let's just call it what it is. He's a legend of finance. So he has several decades of experience at the top of the financial world. I mean, just in terms of his knowledge and his background. So we're going to talk to him as if he is who he is, which is someone completely versed in all the financial terms. But we're going to round out his knowledge from the Bitcoin side.
If you asked this a slightly different way and you said, what is an asset? And then the next question is Bitcoin an asset? I would find that maybe an easier concept initially to understand.
Absolutely.
And what I would say is if you look at the criteria for deciding on an asset, I would list maybe four or five different characteristics. One is ownership or proof of ownership, which I guess is your second bullet here. The second dimension is that the asset has got to hold value in some way. Okay. So in other words, you've got to have some notion that value is predictable. It's not going to, your asset is not going to suddenly melt away, disappear, evaporate, or whatever. You're going to have it tomorrow, and it's going to be largely the same amount that you had, at least the same amount that you have today. So that's, if you like, a scarcity durability question. Okay. The third factor I would say is that you've got to have transferability of the asset. In other words, if you want, somebody else wants it, to recognize the value, you need to transfer that, and you need to transfer that in an easy and cheap manner. Okay. And I guess Bitcoin, because it's an internet protocol, facilitates that point. The fourth point I would say is that you need acceptability. So in other words, people have to recognize, like you, that there's value in this thing. And probably, this is the getting towards the gray area of whether this is an asset or whether it's money per se, is it needs to be acceptable for settling debts. Okay. Now, you can settle debts with an asset, but the point about money is that money gives you instant settlement. And it's good for government taxes, federal taxes. So you can't settle federal taxes with a different currency. and you can't settle federal taxes by transferring an asset. You've got to effectively have money. And that's one of the key factors. And those five or four or five aspects are really what I would say constitutes an asset. And maybe the fifth point is an extra dimension, which is saying this is really what makes that asset money. It's liquid, it's good for settlement, it can give you immediate settlement, etc. Now, if you have those four or five criteria, then is Bitcoin an asset and could it be money? And that's really, I think, a critical question. Or maybe another point is to say, does it really need to be money? Gold isn't really money, but gold's a very liquid asset. And maybe that's enough. So those are the sort of questions that I would kind of raise. And that doesn't necessarily interfere with a lot of the use values of Bitcoin. And those use values could be significant, and they could propel the value of Bitcoin, dramatically higher, as we know. But in terms of the first page, I would say, does it tick the boxes for being an asset? So over to you. I guess it does.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. This is a really important feature. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage with Unchained's trading desk and completely eliminate your exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry. You can convert easily your 401k or IRA into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Go talk to them today, unchained.com/TBL, and make sure you use code TBL for $99 off when you create an account. Imagine losing your Bitcoin fortune to a house fire or to accidental damage. A complete nightmare, right? It's estimated that over 30% of Bitcoin are lost forever, and poor seed phrase security is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed, a really cool DIY kit that allows you to stamp your seed into these titanium plates. So let me show you how it works. They send you a titanium plate. Part of the kit comes with this really easy to use tracker. You slide your seed phrase into the tracker. Now you take the letters that they send you, you take a letter out, and you place it into your device, and then you take this incredibly heavy duty titanium hammer and you hammer your letters into this titanium plate. Your full seed phrase will be stamped into this titanium plate that is fireproof, accident-proof, damage-proof. These tools have been specifically designed by people working in titanium stamping for over 14 years. So go check them out today, stampseed.com, and make sure you use code TBL for 15% off of your order. Yes, so let's start with your last question, which is it an asset and is it money? And gold doesn't necessarily have to be money, but it's a liquid asset, which makes it close to money, but maybe not quite. So that's the way I would approach Bitcoin. And I have an example for you about money market funds, but that's the way I would approach Bitcoin. It's definitely an asset. We're going to check all these boxes for you. It's definitely an asset because it definitely satisfies these properties these characteristics that you laid out. The acceptability for debt settlement, I'm going to get into the nuance there, but the acceptability for debt settlement and the question whether it's money or not are similar in that the answer to is it an asset is yes for both. And even if the answer is not necessarily yes to the money part, it's so close to money and exceeds other monies in some of the other characteristics to the point where it satisfies a monetary criteria to the extent that it is a new technology and is breaking into the sphere as an internet protocol. There's never been an internet protocol that's also a money, so which makes Bitcoin unique. So ownership, yes, without any, or let's just say, categorically, yes, there's ownership proof because of the way that the protocol is designed and the cryptography that underpins the protocol. It's mathematics, it's improbability, it's statistics. So we'll get into those things. So yes, value, you know the answer as well as I do, that Bitcoin has a price. It's been recognized with a price for over, you know, a dozen years. Quite liquid for the last, I would say, 8 years, financialized with options and derivatives for the last 7-8 years. CME was 2017, Michael, for the futures contract there. So going back 7 years, and a price that is, I would say, arguably liquid in 100 countries around the world and 100 currencies, so not just USD, making it uniquely liquid. Even gold doesn't have that type of instant pricing mechanism, not even close. Gold has, there's always a market maker for gold in every city that you go to on the planet, right? There's always a shop that you can go into and get cash, paper for your metal, always. But that price that you get, how close is it to spot? And in your currency, it's going to be highly varied and not nearly as transparent as Bitcoin. So gold is going to be the benchmark here for a lot of this. Transferability, you nailed it with the internet protocol. It's categorical again there that it's transferable, especially with when you combine it with the liquidity and the value recognition, the transferability is key because if you can't send it to the exchange in a few minutes, it's not really liquid. So the fact that you can send it to the exchange, sell it for dollars, and transfer those dollars back to your bank account within hours or a day, you know, if you're in your domestic currency and you're using a good and able exchange and a good and able bank, it shouldn't take you more than 24 hours to turn your actual key into a commercial bank deposit. And so that timing, I want to bring up the acceptability for debt settlement. Because how acceptable for taxes or for debt settlement would you argue a money market fund is, shares in a money market fund? So if you owe $1 million in taxes and you have $1 million USD sitting in your brokerage account, but it's not in it's not in stocks, it's in a money market fund. Would you argue that that is money, Michael? It's an asset, obviously, but is it money? Can it be acceptable for debt settlement?
Well, to the extent that it, if it's underwritten by the state, I mean, this is where it comes back to a finessing the definition of money, that money basically is something which is acceptable for settlement of taxes approved by the state. So, in other words, if you're looking at a money market fund, you're running some counterparty risk with a money market fund. If that money market fund gets into trouble, do they break the buck, for example, is the Federal Reserve likely to come in and back that money market fund? Now, that's not really within their remit, but there are circumstances where that may occur. So if you're looking at a regulated high street bank, that is more likely to be pure money because the state, the US Federal Reserve, is underwriting your deposits in that bank. So in other words, a money market fund is extremely close, but we're looking here at a spectrum or continuum of liquidity or liquid assets. So it's extremely close, but maybe not 100%. A bank deposit in JPM or Citigroup or whatever is much more likely to be 100% money.
And would you agree with me that one of the main logistical hurdles of a money market fund being money is the fact that if you put in your withdrawal notice today, the money market fund has until tomorrow to make the funds available. So they sell securities today in the market to make them settle tomorrow, T plus one, so that the cash is available for a withdrawal. So it's actually just, it's almost a timing thing. From a money market standpoint, whether or not it's money, yes, it's arguably money because it's money the next day available for transfer to the IRS because you can't transfer the share. but you can send a wire deposit and it might take T plus one. So I would argue, obviously not from a price stability standpoint or value stability, meaning par today is par tomorrow on a money market fund. That's not the case with Bitcoin. It's highly volatile. But on a T plus one for taxes or debt settlement, I would argue it's very good now. I mean, it's extremely developed and highly financialized to the point where there's almost no difference as long as, again, as long as you have the able and willing exchanges and banks, and that can't, that's not the case in every country in the world. But then again, it's not the case in every country of the world that you think you can just have the deposit, which is considered money, because their currency might not have that stability either. So that's the way I would argue yes to the acceptability for debt settlement, is using that money market fund as your context. And then your last question about the liquidity profile and the dimensions of Bitcoin. I mean, that's what we're going to unpack here and what you'll have to answer and keep asking me follow up. So how do we feel about those answers?
I think they're all pretty good. I mean, the one that which you highlighted about the volatility in the price is clearly something one's got to address. Clearly, with a money market fund, you know pretty much that you're going to get, if you redeem $100 today, you're going to get $100 tomorrow. With Bitcoin, it's not maybe as straightforward as that, because you have, well, there's a lot more price volatility. But notwithstanding, if you believe that in the longer term Bitcoin is going to appreciate in value, it's more likely to go up than not, then it ticks the box for being an asset that will hold its value in the medium term. And that's broadly how I see it. That's my attraction, or the magnetic force that drew me to Bitcoin, is that I think has served to be a wonderful monetary inflation hedge. So if the US government decides it's going to run big deficits and monetizes those deficits and basically devalues credit money in the dollar, then Bitcoin seems to hold up pretty well. It's outpaced gold over the period. And although it's volatile, it's certainly an asset with clear value, let's say.
And the volatility has to be explained by understanding the terminal value first, which is a little maybe backwards to some people, but here's what I mean. If gold is our best historical context for Bitcoin, because it's a monetary instrument that is universally accepted and recognized without having to explain securities laws or language, it's numbers. So anybody can understand it. Just like gold is a metal, it's an element on the periodic table. So chemists understand what gold is. You don't, which is, chemistry doesn't have a language, right? You can teach chemistry in any language because it's math, it's chemistry. Right. And so Bitcoin as numbers doesn't have to be taught or explained. It's numbers that can be understood by any scientist, right? Any mathematician that is developed in that field, which is called cryptography again, can understand what Bitcoin is because it's just a software that they can see. So if gold is our best context, then gold has to be thought of as the terminal value of Bitcoin in the future. But knowing when gold, which is at 1 trillion today, can get to 17 trillion, Bitcoin, which is at 1 trillion today, knowing when that can get to 17 trillion, which is where gold is, and over that time horizon, will gold still be at 17 trillion? I would argue probably not, that it'll likely be at a higher number, especially because its denominator is fiat. So the terminal value should be how much gold represents as a percentage of wealth globally. Mm-hmm. So let's just say, for argument's sake, that high quality assets wealth is somewhere around 170 trillion. It might be more. We know real estate, stocks, bonds, you know, total several hundred trillion, but let's just argue 170 for the math. So you have 170 of total high quality assets in the world. 17 of that is gold. So 153 trillion of stocks, bonds, and real estate, that's considered high quality wealth. 17 trillion gold and 1 trillion Bitcoin. So if gold is 10% of all of that high quality asset, can Bitcoin either take away 5% of gold so that together it's Bitcoin plus gold equals 10%? Or can Bitcoin grab some of the 90 and make and reduce the amount of gold, of stocks, bonds, and real estate that are the, considered the world's high quality assets because it's recognized this new thing called Bitcoin to replace some of that 90? So if we get to 5 or 10% of that 170 trillion, that puts Bitcoin from $8 to $17 trillion, say that's 7 to 16 trillion in appreciation in the market cap, which the quick way to do it, Michael, is just times are divided by 20. The market cap of Bitcoin will be the supply will never be more than 21 million. It's about 20 million today. So the quick math is that $50,000 is 1 trillion. A price of 50 is 1 trillion. So 10 trillion is 500K. So 500K would put Bitcoin at 11 trillion and $550,000 price. So if the quick and dirty math of my terminal valuation is that Bitcoin gets to $750,000, right, over a time horizon, going from a dollar to 50,000 is obviously going to be volatile. But going from 50 to 750 is going to be just as volatile to the naked eye and even more, even though statistically it'll probably be less on a realized standard deviation basis. To the naked eye, it'll look extreme, because that means one day you'll wake up and Bitcoin will go from 300 to 220,000 in 48 hours, which is almost double the market cap of Bitcoin today. But you'll see a time potentially where the Bitcoin market cap will go down by the market cap that it is today, $1 trillion. Bitcoin goes from 300 to 250 in a day. Can easily happen.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think you're, I would say you're probably not optimistic enough, because I think that, you know, what you're arguing very cogently is that 170 trillion that you suggest, and my figures looking at wealth, financial wealth and real estate wealth worldwide would be actually probably nearer double that. But, you know, keep the math straightforward and let's say it's 170 trillion as a decent figure. So what you're saying is gold is 17. You said 17 trillion or 16,
yes,
17 trillion. So off that, gold is 10% of that. Of that figure of wealth, but it could clearly be a lot more, particularly if there's a monetary inflation. And if you look at the pace of monetary inflation, which gold normally keeps pace with, that seems to be running on in the US alone at something like at least 8% per annum, maybe nearer 10% at times, looking at the size of the federal, prospective size of the federal deficit. In other words, monetary inflation is going to move at a clip which is probably 2 to 3 percentage points faster than nominal GDP growth. And that would give you some benchmark against which to value or assess financial assets, because financial assets should be keeping pace with that monetary inflation. The best of those monetary hedges in the long term has been gold. Equities, good quality equities, has been a decent long-term monetary inflation hedge. Prime real estate, residential real estate, another good one. But Bitcoin, in the last 5 years, has really excelled as an excellent or monetary inflation hedge par excellence. I mean, that's really had a very, very high sensitivity or loading to changes in global liquidity. To give you a benchmark, our estimates would say For gold, it's about 1.5. In other words, every 10% increase in global liquidity leads to about a 15% rise in the gold price. For Bitcoin, historically, and I stress this point, historically, in the last 5 years, it's been about 4 to 5 times. So it's been dramatically faster. It's been at least three times out of gold. That won't apply in the longer term, but you get the point. It's a highly sensitive asset. So I think that it's not just the fact that gold is going to, that Bitcoin is going to take a bite out of gold share. Gold is going to also take a bite out of other asset shares, and the other assets themselves are going to start to inflate because of monetary inflation. So the outlook, if we're correct on Bitcoin, all of us here I'm talking about, the virtues of Bitcoin are pretty staggering.
Absolutely, we would agree with that. And I would even say to you, Michael, that the reason that we don't spend most of our time on trying to determine that terminal value is because it's already high enough. So I, you know, I mentioned two numbers today to you, 550,000 and 750,000. But let's just call it a million so that we can go back to the study of what's going on today, how liquidity is affecting things, as you know, is part of what you do and what we're trying to understand as well here at the Bitcoin layer. So just put the terminal value at a million and then come back and do the work on what's going with the what's going on with the asset class today, what's going on with the monetary system today. We know, we think we understand how it's going to unfold. Like you said, the pace of monetary inflation at 8 to 10%. We believe that's going to hold. So that is what will bring Bitcoin to that terminal value, is the the realization that the monetary inflation is outpacing the GDP. And that's at the center to the, you know, coming up with those types of terminal values. And but it's also why we're not trying to pick 500,000 versus a million. We're just assuming it's high enough that we're trying to understand when we get the next cycle up. We know that it'll hit a ceiling because of fear and greed. And markets always do that, and Bitcoin does that exceptionally well. So we're expecting that a few more times before we get to gold, basically. So let's move forward with the presentation. The next slide is a screenshot from Satoshi Nakamoto's original paper, which was published 3 months before the software protocol was ever sent out to the internet. So he wrote it as an idea, and the idea didn't even have the scarcity mathematics in it. So the fact that there would be 21 million coins, the fact that it would start at 50 coins every block, and that at 210,000 blocks, the reward would shrink to 25 every block. Those specific mathematics were not in this paper. And I think that by itself, that's very interesting, because the paper outlined the cryptography. And now I will explain to you, Michael, why we don't use the word crypto at the Bitcoin layer. The reason we don't use it is because crypto, before Bitcoin, crypto meant cryptography. It was the short form of the word cryptography. So the entire cryptography field, the academic field, which really blossomed after the 70s, when disclosures were made about the NSA and what they were doing with applied cryptography. They were hiring every single cryptography top graduate from every mathematical program around the country. So they had a complete monopoly on the field, on the scientific field of cryptography. That broke down in the 70s and 80s. Then it went crypto. It got popular, where the students at the universities that had the internet were communicating and working on crypto projects. And it was designing cryptography tools like private key cryptography, which underpins Bitcoin. So crypto means cryptography to us. But since the cryptocurrency wave, crypto now means cryptocurrency to the masses, to the world. And we think that that is it's misguided to focus on cryptocurrency. What's important is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin came from cryptography. What is not important is the rest of cryptocurrency, which is called crypto. It may be important to some. It's not important to us. We are global macroeconomic researchers. So in the way that Intel and NVIDIA and Apple and Amazon matter for the global economy because they're massive corporations, but they're not global macro things. Like, you might glance at Apple's earnings, Michael, to give you a beat on, you know, I'm sure you read, you know, and when Apple comes out with earnings, I'm sure you read the article. Okay. I'm sure you read the NVIDIA articles. Okay.
Yeah.
But you don't have a slide on NVIDIA in your in your deck. You know, and when you do a conversation with someone on global liquidity, it's probably not going to come up unless the person asks you, because it's not at the center of your framework. Mm-hmm. So I want to just put that at the beginning here. That's what the word crypto means to the world now, which is cryptocurrency. It's not part of our framework at all. Bitcoin is what matters. Bitcoin is what we focus on, because Bitcoin is the global macro asset. Bitcoin is now over 4 times the size of Ethereum, which is second place, and it's basically 10x, 20x, or 50x everything else. So there's nothing in crypto that's relevant to us as global macro players. Okay, so going to the next slide, which is that Bitcoin is a software protocol. The software protocol itself is how Bitcoin must be understood, which is why the rest of crypto doesn't matter. Protocol evolution, from the internet history perspective, what happens is that people design protocols, which are rules for computers to talk to each other. Then they argue about those rules, and then they figure it out, and everyone in the world starts to use those rules. The rules get maybe tweaked, or the protocol is improved over time for speed, efficiency, but the core rules of these protocols don't change, because it has to be designed in a way that every computer, every software company, every individual, every computer device can use. They have to be universal. So Bitcoin is an internet protocol that is on the same level of universality as TCP/IP, HTTP, email, which is SMTP, and DNS, which is the domain system that we use. It is on that level of, we have decided as a world what we are going to use for the transfer of data. So when we transfer data packets, so the internet, we use TCP/IP. Everyone in the world uses this one protocol, or this pair of protocols that was initially designed as one but was split in the early years because it was the more efficient way to do it. Where the TCP would instruct how the data was sent, and IP was the destination system. So they split these two protocols from one, but that's still what everyone uses. So Bitcoin was a protocol designed to transfer value. We'll unpack what it is that you're transferring, but it was just a system designed for that transfer. And it was a system designed so that every computer in the world could eventually use it. That's the way it was designed. The reason it was designed in that context was that people were trying this, Michael, for arguably for 15 years. I would say even 20 years, because DigiCash was in the early 90s. If people were trying to figure out a way to decentralize money, but the early attempts still had a crypto system and a bank account. So they were still relying on the rails to wire money. And then the idea came, and Adam Back, who designed a early version of Bitcoin, but it wasn't designed to be a currency. It was designed to be a cryptography tool. Adam Back suggested, hey, we need to do this without a bank account. We need to do it on its own rails. And so that was the mission from the 90s, to try to get a system that didn't need, you know, Michael, the wire system, the banking system, the counterparty risk system. They needed a system that was only the internet and your computer. But how could you do it without a ledger to ensure that double spending wasn't happening? How could people ensure that the money wasn't fake? And this is the example that is one of my favorite examples to explain Bitcoin. You know how you can password protect a PDF?
Yeah.
You can email a PDF, right? A PDF is not scarce. You can maybe password protect it. But still, the person with the password can open the PDF, take pictures of it, make a new file, and send it out. You can copy any internet file. You can copy and paste it. But you can't copy and paste Bitcoin. And that is part of what we will try to explain. That's what makes Bitcoin special. We're going to try to explain that to you, why you can't copy paste Bitcoin, but that's what makes it so special. Is they figured out.
Could there be, for example, a better internet protocol for value transfer that surpasses Bitcoin? Or does Bitcoin, it does the job, so there's no need to, if it ain't broke, don't try and fix it.
It's in a later slide, but the answer to your question is that Bitcoin solves a computer science problem called the Byzantine General's problem. Mm-hmm. And once you've solved the problem, you don't have to resolve it. So nobody is attempting to resolve the problem. They fix the problem. The problem has been addressed with Bitcoin, so it works for value transfer. It has amassed the protocol universality that we've discussed. So there's no actual reason to search for a replacement. Combine that with the fact that Bitcoin is 15 years old and the market has tried to find a replacement and failed.
Right.
The reason why crypto isn't a field to us is that while the number two has remained for half a decade, numbers 3 through 10 cycle out every few years. So there's basically always another failure to reinvent Bitcoin on the horizon.
So the Byzantine general problem, as I understand it, is one about information sharing. Is that correct?
Absolutely
You're already just ticking boxes. And if you've ticked the appropriate number of boxes for information sharing, then there's no need to reinvent another box or a different type of tick. It works.
That's absolutely correct. And so in this next slide, Bitcoin's prehistory, I'm going to point out, a few things here. So TCP/IP in 1974, the first internet protocol that became a standard, because before that, it was still a military project. The internet was still a military project, and the recipients of the networked computers were on government contract with ARPA. And so in 74, it's when the internet became usable by the masses, because it was now just a protocol. You didn't have to have a government contract and align to the ARPANET. So that is one parallel in terms of the evolution of internet protocols. But another parallel in the evolution of Bitcoin is cryptography. So in 76, you had a paper, New Directions in Cryptography, and what that paper summarized was this idea that we could have a private public key pair where the private key is your secret number. And the equation that turns the private key into the public key can't turn or doesn't turn the public key back into the private key. And so that one-way cryptography, having possession of the private key, if it's unique and not shared, is yours forever, and it's mathematically improbable to guess that same number because it's the mathematics that we use now in Bitcoin is 2 to the 256th power. And so that's why nobody can just go and hack the Coinbase wallet. You can try, but there's a bounty on it, and that bounty is there 24 hours a day. So the size of the bounties of Bitcoin's large addresses proves how resilient the cryptography is, in addition to the cryptography being of NSA origin and still used by militaries around the world. It's just the it is the military grade cryptography that Bitcoin is using. The algorithm itself is SHA-2 from the SHA-2 family, which was NSA 2001 published, but you know likely existed for many years before that. So going through a little bit of the timeline, one thing I want to flag here is 1989, David Chaum founded DigiCash. So that was the cryptography-based system of currency, but still having ties to the banking system. And that's why it ultimately failed. 1992, Eric Hughes and Tim May really got, let's just say that they were at the beginning of the vocal movement towards let's use internet protocols and cryptography tools to protect ourselves against the government, against a government overreach. So an extremely politically motivated cohort of cryptographers led a movement that ended up with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is a direct descendant of cryptography tools that were designed as protection against government overreach.
Okay.
And yes.
Sorry, let me ask a question just to that point, and it may be a question that you address later, which is probably the obvious question. If you're a government, say you were now on the other side and you're working for the government, how would you stop Bitcoin?
You would have to answer that by asking yourself, who would want to stop Bitcoin?
Well, let's say, for example, that it was they were losing tax revenues or they were losing control of the monetary system. And if people are using Bitcoin, they're not using US dollars. Therefore, there may be an incentive to do that. And I just wonder at this stage, is there a clever way of saying, well, okay, we could actually put a brake on any further use of Bitcoin? I mean, they could make it illegal, but then that wouldn't stop people transacting. Is there anything that they could actually put in place that would actually break the Bitcoin movement? And that's an interesting question, because I would rather suspect that the answer from what you've just said, and looking at this array of data and innovation, is no. They can't do anything.
So I would flip your question around a little bit, Michael, here. Okay? I would argue that Bitcoin is very good for the United States as a country. And I would also argue that Bitcoin does not threaten governments or tax revenue. Bitcoin threatens the banking system's ability to extract resources by being the custodian of our assets. So they are a leech on our wealth by charging us fees for their products and custody. If we are able to free ourselves from the banking system, just take deposits. Just take deposits. Now, deposits are useful for lending. Again, we're going to come back to that in a later lecture, how a credit system can coexist with Bitcoin. But just the fact that Bitcoin eliminates some marginal demand for deposits because you just don't need them. You don't need a custodian. You just have your private key and that's it. It threatens banks, Michael. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin threatens banks. It doesn't threaten governments in the way that people think it does. So you'll have to let me unpack that more. And I'm doing that in my second book, which I'm writing. It really threatens the banks. So all the attacks against Bitcoin, which I include a lot of crypto in that, a lot of the CBDC movement, it is the banks that are the most threatened by Bitcoin. It's not the governments. Now, governments act as agents on behalf of banks. We know this. We know how monetary policy goes. We know how banking lobbies have their power over politicians. And we know how Jerome Powell will pick up the phone when Jamie Dimon is calling, you know, more so than maybe any other individual in the United States government. So I would answer your question first by suggesting that it's not the governments that are threatened, it's the banks. And then I would say that if you had an oil boom in the United States and you had a pro-oil policy, would the oil boom generate US dollar tax revenues because you would have realized profits in US dollars at some point because of increased activity broadly? Yes, you would. And I would suggest that a Bitcoin embrace in the United States, both on a mining, financial products and services, converting Bitcoin to US dollars and back to generate or to borrow, spend, invest. I would argue that a Bitcoin, pro-Bitcoin policy is additive to the US government tax base in almost every single way. Because the marginal, the small fraction of law breakers that are going to be like the people that evade all sorts of exposure to the US government, go financially off the grid per se, and don't contribute into the tax base, I would argue that that would be completely outweighed by the pro side. Okay. Which is that it's just a commodity, and a bull market in that commodity, with domestic companies working to produce it, transfer it, provide financial services for it, serve the clients, would all be good. And I think that that is actually happening in the United States. We talked about that last time, a tacit acceptance from the legal standpoint with the ETF approval. I mean, that is the signal that we are the global home of Bitcoin here in the US. And we were okay being a little bit late, but BlackRock, Fidelity are now Bitcoin behemoths, JP Morgan and Coinbase. These are the four now Bitcoin behemoths. Unfortunately for a lot of Bitcoiners, three of them are legacy companies and one of them is on its way to becoming, you know, a full Wall Street darling. But that's the way that the asset class has evolved. And it doesn't, just the fact that BlackRock is in doesn't change the fact that it uses private key cryptography in which you can own the number that controls your entry on the ledger and no one else can come up with that number and just steal your money and nobody owes it to you and JP Morgan doesn't have your keys.
Okay, let me just counter that. I mean, I accept your argument about this is very much in the US interest to actually be a crypto or a Bitcoin power. I mean, that makes eminent sense to me. There's a lot of ways that the US government could benefit, particularly if you extend this argument out maybe to stable coins, but that is a different argument. But let me just take the question of taxation. if you've got a young population or a young society where there are not that many financial assets in existence, but there are transactions, it's relatively easy to tax transactions, be those wage payments or be those goods and services payments, that's fine. But once you get an older society where transactions are eclipsed by asset holdings, wealth taxes have to be a lot more important. Now, if I hold my wealth in a Bitcoin wallet, who knows? It's there. Okay, I can evade wealth taxes because governments have no knowledge of my holdings. Isn't that a threat?
So that's why I wanted to just put the banks against the government in terms of the enemy of Bitcoin at first. Just to show you where I'm coming from in terms of who's going to try to attack Bitcoin. However, I fully accept that there is a large faction of government that wants to prevent all financial privacy, that wants to prevent you from using Bitcoin to evade wealth taxes, that wants to prevent you from using Bitcoin because it makes them less powerful as a government. It's a statement on the currency itself and the usability of a currency, which is in the government's name, even though we know banks control the issuance of it to a large part. So all of your points are valid, and all of them suggest that you will have a party, that's the way it's kind of developing now, that you'll have a political party, one of the two, that policies are aimed at preventing the free use of Bitcoin, making sure that there's a Bitcoin tax or that there's a special tax or that there's special disclosures that need to be done for Bitcoin. I would suggest all of that. I mean, we have evidence of it, Operation Choke Point 2.0, explicit policies from the Treasury Department, from the White House, targeting this industry. So it's not that you're wrong, Michael, that governments are a threat to Bitcoin or that they're working towards it. But governments are the agents of the people. Banks are not the agents of the people. And so Bitcoin has become politicized. And so if there are anti-Bitcoin policies, you might have people vote those people out and put in pro-Bitcoin policies. I imagine in my optimism, that's the way that it will unfold in the United States. That's my base case based off of, I think, the way that it's gone. Despite Operation Choke Point 2.0, Bitcoin is still doing great as finding a home in the US for companies looking to build on Bitcoin services. But doesn't mean that I just think the government is going to be pro-Bitcoin. I fully recognize. And so we'll get back to your question, which is what can governments do? They can make it really difficult for companies to bank in Bitcoin and just make it, introduce special taxes or special laws that single out Bitcoin transactions for taxable purposes or for, violation of privacy purposes. And those things will really challenge the use of Bitcoin in the United States, which, as the global economic leader, will be a challenge to Bitcoin's adoption and growth. I would accept that as a threat to Bitcoin's adoption path, but then just mention that, yes, Bitcoin, because it's an internet protocol, it will find its way, just like the internet, like TCP/IP was fought against in Europe because they wanted to go with their solution. OSI was the name of the organization, right? That had. And so Bitcoin will find its way as a value transfer mechanism because it's already globally recognized. The government can do its best to try to stop. And I think banks are doing their best to launch a tax against Bitcoin, which could include the entire cryptocurrency field potentially, launched to try to distract away from a globe that could adopt Bitcoin as a universal digital store of value.
Right. Okay. But I would, you know, I would say in my understanding of this, the challenge that Bitcoin poses is perhaps in terms of reducing the ability of banks to do transfers. That may be clear. It would certainly reduce the cost of transfers because Bitcoin is presumably a more efficient mechanism for doing that. But then there could also be other rivals, such as the Ripple XRP as another vehicle, perhaps. But that, you know, that's clearly another story. The real threat must be to the conventional asset managers, because Bitcoin is, I'm seeing it as an asset here, and you've always got to buy and sell an asset to realize the value. And in other words, you can't destroy bank deposits, because basically if I sell my Bitcoin, I get a bank deposit. We're just sort of trading bank deposits, but those bank deposits are inflating in value. So the bank, in terms of banks, in terms of money supply growth or deposit growth, surely are not that effective. You're just really substituting Bitcoin for maybe an equity or whatever that may be, or another type of asset. So it's the conventional asset managers that are probably under greater threat. Is that not right?
So it's an excellent point. And I would suggest that everyone is actually under threat, but the order in which they're under threat is arguable. So if, let's just take one person at a time. So let's say a young person likes Bitcoin, likes using a Bitcoin wallet, has a way to turn Bitcoin into fiat easily without having a deposit relationship at a traditional bank. That bank loses a lifetime customer, essentially. A customer that they depend on the next generation coming in. So the bank is threatened. The government's threatened, as we discussed, for a variety of reasons, especially the faction of the government that wants to infringe on your privacy and your ability to transact privately. An asset manager is threatened because if one is holding their wealth in Bitcoin, they don't need a PIMCO fund. They don't need an ETF. They don't need an RIA, a wealth advisor. So all of those people then, you know, lose their job. And so there's a bunch of sectors of the financial industry that are going to lose customers because of Bitcoin. But think about global real estate. So all those London flats that people from, we know, Russia and various countries across the world, they come in and they hold their wealth in London flats or coastal real estate in the United States. These assets, what about the young person that comes into a large deal and with 20 million, instead of buying four properties, they buy one house and 15 million of Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Then the marginal demand for multi-million dollar prime real estate mansions goes down at the margin. So everybody is threatened at the margin by Bitcoin, but by how much? Are the real estate brokers of the world going to unite and try to launch an attack against Bitcoin today? I mean, I just don't think so. Are the BlackRocks and the PIMCOs going to launch an attack against Bitcoin, or are they just going to launch an ETF and try to get some of those fees? I would argue it's the latter.
Correct.
And that they're going to do it. So different parts of the world will react in different ways to Bitcoin. But one of Bitcoin's most powerful advantages is the fact that it's an internet protocol without a company or a government to interact with in order to use it. And because of that, Bitcoin has arguably hundreds of millions of users already. Right? So how many years until 1 billion people are using Bitcoin? And at the point where a billion people are using Bitcoin, what can anybody do to stop it or to fight it? Like, what are you doing to fight this thing?
Correct.
It's like fighting the internet. Yeah. Who is fighting the internet? Who is fighting our ability to turn on a computing device and go onto the HTTP network, the World Wide Web, communicate with each other there using TCP/IP via our routers, our Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is another protocol, you know, universal protocols. Who's fighting to say, hey, we got to get these Wi-Fi routers out of our city or out of our country? It's just a technology that makes life better for everyone. So it's the people are the power of Bitcoin, actually. And the people are what drives the price, because the people that buy it or save in it and refuse to sell it, right? Which enforces the scarcity.
I think, a use case, a very clear use case, is the one that you just highlighted, which is basically international real estate. And you can see a compelling argument there for holding wealth in Bitcoin. That really does, I think, shine through very strongly. A compelling case. And so you've got to say that within portfolios, whatever the percentage that's in real estate or second homes or whatever the asset class you call it, that could seriously come under threat. So real estate brokers, they're the ones that are certainly going to suffer in that sort of win-lose environment. But I think, I get this. I mean, there's a win-win case for Bitcoin, but there's also a periphery that says there are going to be losers out there, as you highlight. But I think that as you run through this, the compelling case for holding Bitcoin is clearly there as an alternative means of holding wealth.
And in our next episode, we are going to get into hashing and mining so that you, Michael, can see that XRP or other cryptocurrencies, they're not a substitute. They might be used for one of these items that you describe, which is the transferability. But transferability doesn't mean anything for an asset or for money by itself. Transferability does nothing. The ownership itself and the value itself of Bitcoin are the things that underpin why it's the universally accepted. And the reason that Bitcoin has value is because it can't be copy-pasted. It can't be altered from its schedule. And in our next episode, we'll get into hashing, Bitcoin supply, and Bitcoin's mining algorithm so that you can start to see how secure the supply is. Because even Ethereum, the second place cryptocurrency by market value, has had multiple changes in its supply schedule from whom, Michael? Mm-hmm. A group of guys, a group of men called the Ethereum Foundation and other developers in the ecosystem. Basically, people have changed it. And XRP is a company. And these things, they can all be changed. Bitcoin cannot be changed. We will teach you why. Thank you guys at home for this part one of teaching Michael Howell how Bitcoin works. We didn't actually get into how Bitcoin works, but we started to understand some of the characteristics of Bitcoin and how we approach it. So I hope that you enjoyed today, Michael, and looking forward to reactions and continuing this conversation very much.
Great, Nick. Thank you. Look forward to it. Very, very interesting. I'm convinced.
Okay, guys. Thank you, guys. And we'll catch you guys next time.